Let's get into the book of Proverbs. Last week, you remember that we went through all the verses that you see on the screen here, and we've been going through a section that is just really ugly. You know, one of those kind of hard parts of the book of Proverbs. We're dealing here with the use of the word evil and those people who are described that way. So at this point, we've seen about half of the scriptures that deal with evil, defining it for us, explaining how to avoid people who are guilty of it and therefore dangerous, how to avoid becoming evil yourself. And so we're getting, you know, a wide variety of insight into evil people. There's lots of them. Today, as we mentioned last week, you hardly ever hear the word used, you know, we're just afraid to even talk about it, but there's a great deal of it in the book of Proverbs. And then at one point here, at 1526, there was a suggestion, at 1503, I guess it was. At 1503, the omniscience of God, the fact that He knows everything that goes on in this earth, He knows that evil people are seeking to harm the righteous. And so we get a little diversion right here and look at all the passages, at least that I can find in the book of Proverbs, that just deal with God's knowledge, His foreknowledge and complete knowledge of all things. So that's why the different color right here, if you weren't here last week, you want to jot these down first, because I'm taking them off the board now, and then these will remain if you want to jot them down. But we're really dealing with the topic of evil, and then since there was so much of it, we have these other verses where God is saying, however, I know, and I'm not neglecting you, I'm not forgetting you, I'm not ignoring you, I have the power, you know, to take care of these things, and I will, but rest assured, you know, I understand, I know what it is that you're going through. So what we're going to do tonight, probably for the rest of the night, I suppose, is deal with guys like this. You know who that is? Instant recognition now, you know, after the kidnappings and 10 years of torture and now, you know, being freed in Cleveland, you know, recognize those guys. Okay, well, there's the two brothers, you know, that did the Boston Marathon bombing. And brethren, these are, you know, extremes. Most everybody would be able to say, you know, there's evil for you, just personify. Here are minds that are so dark and, you know, so sinful, just so opposed to anything that is decent and righteous and good, and the lost, you know, the most basic qualities of the heart, where a human being has a natural inclination to be helpful to their fellow man. What happens whenever you have an accident, or you have a fire, or you have anything? You know, what do people do? They rush to help. It's the natural, you know, human state. We recognize in similar species, you know, we want to reach out and help. Your mind, at a very young age, well, he was 19, I guess, you know, and so 26, I think, the brother was, and then 52, I think it is, in the middle, you know, there's no age discrimination. But to just lose your bearings utterly. We are surrounded by these people. They're absolutely everywhere. And so little wonder then that God spends such a large amount of time in the book of Proverbs giving us insight and advice on how to deal with this. So as I say, if you weren't here last week, we've already covered all of those verses and you want to just jot them down. But we're going to continue our discussion here. So the next passage is in chapter 16. In chapter 16 at verse 6, by loving kindness and truth, iniquity is atoned for. And by the fear of the Lord, one keeps away from evil. Now, I thought I would just kind of leave this open for you to think about a little bit, because, you know, I'm not so sure in this case that I know, you know, very confidently what this passage is saying. Solomon's wisdom, miraculous as it is, you know, surpasses ours, and we're going to be learning as you go through your entire life. And so don't be surprised when you look at a verse, as I'm doing right now, and saying, well, I can see a couple of different things in here, you know, and I'm not sure exactly what's happening here. But at first thought, by loving kindness and truth, iniquity is atoned for. If we're going to atone for iniquity, two things are necessary. They're going to work together. loving kindness, and truth. Now, if iniquity is going to be atoned for, what would be your first thought on who is doing the atoning, and therefore whose loving kindness is involved? Well, God is what first comes to mind. And so on God's part, there's compassion, there's mercy, there's loving kindness. And so God is willing to pay the price, this is what atoning has to deal with, to pay the price for iniquity. But what was the other quality or condition that's named? Truth. Loving kindness and truth. Now certainly if God didn't do his part in loving kindness, we wouldn't have the mercy, we would not have the forgiveness. What about truth though? Now truth can only come from God, but now, does my loving kindness atone for iniquity the way we're thinking about it right now? You know, no, it's God's loving kindness, it's his truth. But what's my relationship to truth if sin will be atoned? That's for me to find and what? Respond to it, you know, to obey it. And so I think, you know, first level, we'll look at a different view of this in a minute, but in the first level, you know, is just a marvelous discussion of how God in heaven looks down upon the earth and all this evil and iniquity that we're talking about, and bad as it is, he will atone for it. But it takes two things, and I think not surprising for us to conclude, if you were to take either one away, then that iniquity is not going away either, is it? You need to have that truth, or you're not going to have this atoning that God is offering in his loving kindness. His loving kindness is expressed in a truth. If that truth is ignored, denied, you rebel against it, refuse it, he's not going to atone for iniquity. Yeah, Michael first and then Carolyn. Oh, is that right? You have faithfulness. Okay. You see how closely related they are. And now you get to the very thing I was talking about. If there's truth, what is our responsibility? Is to have faith in it and be faithful to it. So it comes to the same thing. Okay, Carol?
You have to come to the truth of what you've done, that it is a sin against God. You don't recognize the truth.
See, absolutely, that's the case. And today, with the Mormons, I was working with that a little bit. I brought the passage up several times. You shall know the blank, and the blank shall set you free. You shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free. And so I proposed to them that I had two problems with the Mormon church in that regard. In the first place, they're teaching the truth, many plain and precious promises and covenants, that's a quote from 1 Nephi 13, were taken away by the great and abominable church, which they, some of them, identify as Roman Catholic Church, but ultimately, Satan himself is mentioned there, so that truth was turned into Swiss cheese, giant gaping holes in it, and promises and covenants and many precious parts, you know, are all taken out of it. Well, if Jesus tells us, you shall know the truth shall set you free, then he said, you shall what? Know the truth. That truth cannot go away. This foundation stone of Mormonism that the truth went away, it cannot be so. Because Jesus said, you'll know it, and it'll set you free. It'll be available. They say, no, it's not for 1,800 years. Okay? And then, of course, I secondarily pointed out, what sets you free in that passage? The truth. In the Mormon church, how will you know that Mormonism is true? Can anybody except Jerry tell me? Anybody tell me? What do they tell you to do to know that the Book of Mormon and the Mormon church is true? What do they ask of you? Correct. Okay. They added a whole bunch of books to the Bible that are collected into a book they call the Book of Mormon. In the last book, in the 10th chapter, right at the end of the Book of Mormon, raise your hand if you have a copy of the Book of Mormon. you, I have a copy of the Book of Mormon. And familiarize yourself with it. It'll work with it a little bit. There's only two passages I think you really need. First Nephi 13, that's the first book, chapter 13. And then the last book, chapter 10. First book and last book, those two passages. But in Moroni, at the end there, that passage says that all you have to do is pray. Pray real hard, as Greg said. And then what will happen? You pray real hard, and what will happen? You'll feel it. Carol goes like this and touches her heart. You'll feel it. It's going on and on and on. How wonderful this feeling is. And I said, okay, well, I pulled out my copy of the Book of Mormon, which I received in 1974. It's got a signature and a Salt Lake City address in it. And I wrote underneath it that I had run out of gas in Utah, and this woman, Margaret Young, picked me up in June of 1974, you know, and asked me to read the book and pray real hard, and I would feel it. So I told these young men, and the older guy again today, I think the reason that I never did become a Mormon, though, was because while I read the book and I prayed about it, I wanted to know if it was true. I did two things, I told them, that I don't think anybody in the Mormon church does. Well, that had their attention. So I said, these two things are this. I kept reading my Bible while I was reading the Book of Mormon. I didn't lay my Bible aside. I kept reading it and comparing the two. And I know Mormons don't do that, but I did. And so I saw many contradictions between the two as I was going along. And I said, secondly, I approached it from a logical, rational, intelligent viewpoint rather than a good feeling that made my body, you know, sense something. And that I didn't trust my flesh and my feelings as much as I did logic and reason in the search for truth. And again, you can see they're just kind of backpedaling a little bit because they're seeing that when you translate their experience like that and speak it back to them, they realize, well, it really does look pretty flimsy that I wasn't weighing any evidence. And all I was doing was waiting for a sensation in my body and emotion. Well, the flesh is a pretty dangerous foundation, isn't it? Okay? So what is this saying? What are the two things you need? Pray hard and wait for a feeling? No, you need God's loving kindness and what? Truth. And then we haven't even got to the second part here. And then it says, and by the fear of the Lord, one does what? Keeps away from evil. Now, brethren, what you've got right there in your Old Testament, I think, is the same formula that will work in the New Testament. Old Testament or New, from Adam and Eve's sin in the garden to today, to the last day, what do we need from God? Loving kindness and truth. What do we need to do with regard to that truth if we're going to have iniquity atoned, covered, expunged, removed, paid for? If we're going to get rid of that evil, then what do we have to do with the truth? Know it, accept it, embrace it, practice it. Okay? So now, today, under the New Covenant, we are baptized into Christ for the, what's the book, chapter, verse, okay. So we're going to repent, be baptized for the forgiveness of our sins. And then when you rise from the water, you'll never experience another temptation. Oh, see, a person went into the water, comes back out, you've been forgiven. But what is the third component part of this verse say? It's the last half of the verse. Then what comes into play? By the fear of the Lord, what happens? You can avoid evil in the future, see, from now on. So an atoning for past sin is going to take place as a function of God's loving kindness and the truth. His offering, our receiving that truth. And then, once we are washed in the blood of Jesus the Christ now, we still are going to be tempted. We're still going to have weaknesses, faults, and failures. We still have a trouble with all the stuff we talked about last week. So, in the last half of verse 6, by the fear of the Lord, one keeps away from evil. That's how you're going to resist it in the future. Okay, now all of that had to do, though, with thinking about atoning for sin, you know, from God's standpoint. Now, what about if somebody sins against you? Could this verse apply to interpersonal relationships when somebody sins against me? Well, and again, I think it could. And that's why I say it's kind of a struggle for me. I'm not sure here, because I think it's equally true that if somebody sins against me, what should my attitude be toward them? What was God offering to me? Loving kindness. See, remember the parable. Here's this guy, you know, he owes the king forgives him, he goes and throttles his fellow servant, you know, pay me what you owe me, see, and winds up, you know, in prison. Okay, well, the Lord was pretty unhappy with that whole program. So if I want to be forgiven, and God extends to me loving kindness, what should I do when people sin against me? Loving kindness. And by truth, iniquity is atoned for. Let's think about our personal relationship right here and see if you can cite a verse from Matthew chapter 18, verses 15 through 18.
There's two.
That might bear on this. What does that passage say? If someone sins against you, go to him and him alone, see, and you talk with your brother. Now, what are you going to do there? You're going to talk about truth, aren't you? You're going to have a discussion about what happened here. But you're pleading your case in the hope that your brother will realize what? Well, I sinned against you. I'm sorry. I hope you forgive me. Okay? And then, what does the rest of the verse say? Verse 6, and by the fear of the Lord, then what? It's not going to happen again. Hopefully, that sin won't be committed by your brother against you or anybody else again. But remember in the passage, if he doesn't hear you, then what do you do? You bring witnesses. Witnesses of what? What are the witnesses doing?
The truth.
They're talking about the event and the truth of the event. They can testify as to whether or not that individual sinned against you. They're not just there to hear a story and pass a judgment. They're here to testify that, you know, every fact may be established. It's a little court trial here, and you're calling your witnesses is what it's about. Okay, but then, if they hear them, you tell it to the church. If they don't, if they hear the church, you know, you have three levels where your brother responds, your sister responds, all is well and happy. See, that's what we're hoping for. And then in the process of talking with you alone, of talking with one or two others that you called in as witnesses to convince them of this sin, and then having it brought before the whole church, what are you trying to produce in them? Yes, repentance. That's absolutely right. I'm going to just use a different phrase, the one that's in the last half of the verse. The fear of the Lord. So what it's all about is having them draw back from this to fear God and, you know, worship and serve Him. So I know that's a lot of time on that verse 6, being only one verse, we've got a whole side of the board to go, but isn't that a really important verse? Because I think it gives you, as I say, a formula, Old Testament or New, on how God is going to save humankind. Okay? But it also gives us some insight that maybe we ought to practice these principles ourselves when our brothers and sisters, you know, sin against us. Now it's our turn to play the Lord's role and try to see to the forgiving of sin. Okay, any comment or question on that? Next, we'll next verse in chapter 16, verse 17. So in 16, 17, the highway of the upright is to depart from evil. He who watches his way preserves his life. Now, then as now, is a highway a narrow little footpath through the grass? What's a highway? So if in 17, the highway of the upright is what? What's the road we want to stay on? Stay away from evil. And we got a highway. The whole point really of a highway, think about this, brethren. What is the point of a good road?
To
What are you trying to do when you build a road? Yeah, probably all those answers are right, but too many. What you're trying to do, brethren, think of it this way. What you're trying to do is to shove back the bushes. Okay. You're trying to get rid of all the rough spots. What you're trying to do is to keep yourself and your vehicle as far away from what as you can. Yeah, nature, danger. You're trying to, you know, create a road so that you can stay away from having to drive your car through the humps and bumps and all of the bushes and crashing in the trees and dodging the deer, which you may still have to do in Oregon.
I wear not. But see the point? So the highway in verse 17 of the upright is what? Get as far away from evil as I can. I'd like my highway to be about 14 lanes. Okay? And then I'm going to drive right down the middle. See? As far away as you can. And then, he who does what preserves his life? He who watches his way preserves his life. So the picture you have is of an individual who selects a particular highway because it's very well built, it's nice and big, you know, it's as big as the thing can get, and that's his delight and joy, that's the road that he wants to be on. And then, when he's on it, what is he still doing? He's watching his way. He's still paying attention, even when he's on it. And what will that do for your life? Preserves your life. Stay away from all that evil. 16:27. A wordless man digs up evil, while his words are as a scorching fire. That's pretty much like James set on fire of Gehenna, even, isn't it? Pretty reminiscent of that. But, you know, evil people's words, what do? They're destructive, they burn, they hurt. They're like a fire, you know, they ruin. That's what evil people's words are like. Well, if we're on a highway of uprightness and watching our way while we're doing that, there going to be many of those kind of words in our mouths? No. Christians are not into gossip. Christians are not into slander. Christians are not into put-downs and you know, zingers. It's a nice word. Or, you know, when you're slamming somebody, it's not good. This passage would suggest you're on the wrong highway, to draw from the other one. A worthless man digs up evil, while his words are as a scorching fire. So we're not digging up evil, and we're not blistering anybody. Our words are to be with grace, seasoned with salt, so that we may what? What book is that? Colossians. Let your words be with grace, seasoned, they usually add as it were, with salt, that you may know how to answer every man. This is what the Christian is about. Having a highway that we're staying on, delight in, and then not digging up any evil at all, we're not interested in that at all, and trying to find words that are graceful, gracious words that will be exactly what everybody, you know, needs to hear. Okay? I think it's 4:12, but I could be wrong. It's not ringing a bell for me, but let me look and see. No, that's too late. Where's, two words be with grace, even with salt? 4:6. Yeah, it's chapter 4, verse 6. Okay? Okay, and then the last one in chapter 16 is down at verse 30. He who winks his eyes does so to devise perverse things. He who compresses his lips brings evil to pass. So what's all that about? Secret signals. The kind of stuff that Ron over here does at buy marks when a customer comes in and they want to flee. So he winks over there at one of the other salesperson, you know, and then the two of them collude to come over there and rip that guy off, right? Ron, what? No! But, you know, it has to do with secret signals of people doing that kind of stuff because they have nefarious motives and they're in collusion with somebody else
And so now, you know, we're doing some kind of a snow job on somebody, you know, for personal gain. What are Christians like as opposed to that? Open, honest, one of my favorite words is forthright. Isn't that a great word? Forthright. Just kind of pours out right, doesn't it? Right is coming forth. But a forthright person is what? Just very, another word I like a lot, very akin to it, is straightforward. This is what Christians are. You know, we're not devious. We're not seeking personal gain. We're not trying to get on top of somebody else. You know, we're not looking for advantage. What is the Christian's kind of ultimate duty toward the rest of mankind? We are to be their servants. Servants following the master's footsteps. Okay? Well, now with verse 30 is all about. He winks his eyes, not serving anybody else. He's cheating that person. He's devising a perverse thing. And this compressing of his lips, again, is a signal. It's kind of like this. How many of you recognize that one? Oh, come on. The Robert Redford movie. Paul Newman. The Sting. Go home tonight. Watch The Sting. Touch to the nose. With all the con men, you know, making their signals, as this was all about. Okay, the con men question on chapter 16. All right, chapter 17. About halfway through tonight, looks like we're doing pretty good. So, chapter 17, you got three verses. 11 is the first one. A rebellious man seeks only evil. So, a cruel messenger will be sent against him. Both the Old Testament and the New Testament use a different phrase that describes that principle. You will reap what you sow. You reap what you sow. So a rebellious man seeks only evil. He's always up in arms and fighting everybody and everything. You know, it's the ultimate activist is the word I think they use today. You know, it's people that are always screaming and crying and, you know, fighting against something. And then, what's he going to get? A cruel messenger will be sent against him. Now, you know, I believe in whistleblowers. I believe in keeping the government honest. You know, and the IRS is another one of these evil faces I couldn't put up here until they spoke this week. We're finding out about that. And the Biden administration was, you know, taking the Associated Press's emails, you know, all that kind of thing. I believe in whistleblowers. I really do. But is it the Christian's responsibility to rebel against government? No, we are to render unto the things that are Caesar's. And the only time you're going to fight the government is when what? When did the apostles fight the government? Now Rome, you understand, never had a bad law. Rome never did an evil thing. Why, their emperors were paragons of virtue and wise as Solomon, so every Roman law was just perfect, wasn't it? What was the tax system like then? Considerably worse than our IRS, wasn't it? Considerably worse. You've all heard the story. So the king would decree how much had to come out of this particular location, and some guy would bid and how much money he could get out of that particular city or region, and then once he had collected all the money that he had to give to the king, because he promised the king he could get that much, how did he get paid?
Everything
else that he could take away from the people. It was just inherently, you know, cruel and burdensome. And it was a horrible system, and that's why the Jews hated tax gatherers so much. Okay, and you remember then all the demonstrations where the Christians fought against the Roman taxation system, right? Where do you read about that? You don't. Okay, so they learn to get along with it, and what does Romans 13 tell you? Romans 13 is all about what? Well, the first half.
Obeying the
laws of the land that you live in. Okay, so fine, you know, you want to vote, you do your voting, and you do all that. But Christians' responsibility is so much higher. It's so much more important. We've got better things to be doing and worrying about whether the IRS, you know, ripped us off for $1,000 more than they should have this month, you know. Other things to be concerned about, brethren. There's a world of sin out there to be avoided. There's a world of sinners to bring to Christ. In this passage, in 17:11,
a rebellious man, that spirit is really seeking only what?
Evil.
It's a rebellious spirit. You don't want to be rebellious. And he's going to reap what he sowed. 13. He who returns evil for good, evil will not depart from his house. Well, you reap. It's pretty much the same thing, isn't it? That's the end of verse 20. He who has a crooked mind finds no good, and he who is perverted in his language falls into evil. Now, once again, brethren, I think it works both ways, but as I think about verse 20, in the first half especially, I can see two different ways to understand this. First, he who has a crooked mind finds no good. If your whole mindset is that there's no good to be found, then what will you find? You won't find any good. See, if that's your mindset, one of the first counseling sessions I was ever involved in just broke my heart. Young couple came to me, marital problems, wanted to study. Fine, so we had 6, 8 candles. I don't know how many times I went over the house, I studied with this couple. And the first or second time, I guess it was, that I was sitting at the table, this young wife says to me, and her husband's there, and she says, emphatically, dogmatically, it is impossible to have a happy marriage. So I know that. My parents were unhappy, the grandparents were unhappy, and I had never known a happy marriage. I know it is impossible to have a happy marriage. Guess what her marriage was like? What kind of heart has she got? What is she looking for? What does she find? We call it a self-fulfilling... Yeah, you ever heard the phrase? It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Where am I at here? 1720, I guess it is. I lost my place. Last verse on my page there. He who has a crooked mind just can't see any good. They just can't find it. Well, why not? They're not looking for it. They're not looking for it. So they'll never find it. And he who is perverted in his language, then what? Falls into evil. Now, you young parents, you got kids at home still. Here's a passage you want to show your kids. Now, they're going to school every day and being carefully trained for hours at a time on how to do what? How to swear. I remember practicing, don't you? I remember practicing how to swear. My daddy taught me. Now, he never said, son, sit down here, I want to teach you how to swear. You ever do that? No, my dad was never a Christian. He was a profane man. And so, I was learning how to do it. I remember practicing, trying to use the same inflections and the proper emphasis, to make those words so I get it just right. Well, wait a minute. If you're perverted in your language, then what follows at the end of verse 20? Okay. Is it possible, brethren, to program your mind with profane, evil language and thoughts and then just be innocent as the pure grim of snow?
No.
What's going to happen if you use that language? You will become that kind of person. Now, the kids will argue that, oh, it's just words. Doesn't mean anything. I'm able to divorce myself, from what I'm saying. Would this verse suggest any of that? No. Okay? So what you're doing there, whether you like it or not, we now have divine wisdom to help us appreciate it, you are programming yourself for evil when you use the language of the evil. You're going to find it. You're programming yourself for it. The last three words are, in my text, you will fall into evil. You set yourself up for it. It's unavoidable. Okay, so you work with your kids. They say, it's not just because I said so. It's because God is teaching us here that what that is guiding you, leading you, hemming you in. So when your choices are being narrowed and where you're going to come out is with evil. That's the way language works. So you program yourself
It's only upright and wholesome words. You season your words. You let your words be with. That's right. The first word, let them be with grace. Season with salt that you may what? Know how to answer every man. No slander, no gossip, no put downs. We saw that in the preceding verse. No kind of harm or evil ever dictated. Every word is calculated so that it's a benefit to the person that hears. This is the Christian's way, and I keep translating, of course, in the Old Testament. They have Christians in, but they certainly had faithful people. And the principles are the same. Okay, chapter 19, verse 23. Any hands up? There you go, Carol.
Yeah, I think so. In fact, I think I set out to say there were 2 ways to look at it, and I only gave one, didn't I? And yours is the other. But yeah. Bill, can I ask you to give me that glass of water? Could you show this up? Bill, would you show that for me, please?
Okay. Yeah, and a good point. I just forgot to get to that. Okay, 1923, turn the page. The fear of the Lord leads to life, so that one may sleep how? And untouched by evil. Satisfied and untouched by evil. Now, Dawn and I moved here in August. We occupied the house we're in right now on the 8th of August. So many of you came over and helped us move in that day, and I really appreciate it. And it was hot. Was I alive? Yeah, you know, it was in the summertime. And I remember in that very first month that we were in that house, reading about somebody in Eugene who had left a window up because it was so hot, and then what had the burglar done during the night while they were sleeping? He broke in on it. And so here's a passage that's just wonderfully comforting, you know, in 1923. The fear of the Lord leads to life so that one may sleep satisfied, untouched by evil. Both in the sense that you're not practicing any, but we've seen numerous passages in our preceding studies about how God will also protect you. So, every night when you go to sleep, brethren, do all the evil people go to sleep too? No, what were a whole lot of them doing? Well, here's my opportunity now. Every night, all around you, sometimes really close to you, huh? Yeah. And then what? For righteous people, untouched by that evil. Now for the 419th time, does the Bible not teach that there will be exceptions to this? Sometimes righteous people have bad things happen to them. Yes, but what's the general program? Great encouragement here in 1923, that you fear the Lord. Do that, and then what? Life, satisfaction, and protection. Can you beat that? Sounds pretty good to me. So give me some of that. Carol?
To go back to that, it seems to me that it's talking about you trusting that
Yeah, absolutely, and that's the part of the wisdom that we're being taught, you know, is that you don't say, well, I love the Lord, so I'm not even going to put any screens on my windows. I'm going to, remember the old Bill Cosby routine after he learned how to do karate? So he would only go out after midnight in dark alleys with dollar bills hanging out of his pockets. He knew karate. Well, that could work for you. That's not wise. Carol said you'd be wise. You know, and God is watching out for you. Okay, on to chapter 20, verse 22. Do not say, I will repay evil. Wait for the Lord.
and he will save you. Now, you know, we were just talking about the protection from evil, untouched by it, in verse 23 of the preceding chapter, weren't we? But what does this verse say is going to happen sometimes? Evil is going to come your way, and you're going to be tempted to want to give it right back. Just dish that stuff right out. What do? Wait for the Lord, and he will save you. Okay? I think we touched on this when we were doing a segment on anger, remember, here a few months back. Have you ever heard somebody say, count to 10? Does that work?
No.
Really well. Works great. What did this verse say at the first part of the second half?
Wait!
Wait! Now, Bill, you're going to have to work on your counting skills. It sounds like maybe you should count to 20. But as you're going to find in Scripture, that advice is very common. That you just wait. Be patient. See, if you just don't react, and instead you choose to think, decide, and then act, be a whole lot better. Let me skip over Rachel. I see your hand, but Esther was first. There you go. Seen that one before. Let go and let God. Vengeance is mine. Well, that's what it said. Vengeance is mine. Vengeance is his. See, if we were to translate it again, that's what that is. Now, Rachel was next.
I think wait can mean more than just being patient and not doing something. That wait is like a servant or a weak person.
I don't think so in this case, Rachel. Let me look at it again. It doesn't strike me that way, but you know, it's one of those deals again where it certainly is true. If I serve the Lord, you know, his promise is to protect us, to save us. So I see your reasoning, and I know the Scriptures teaches a similar thing, but I just don't know. I don't think that word right here, I'm not sure in that language, I just don't know, if in that language it would intend wait in the two senses that we do in English. In English,
a lot of people sit around and they're still praying and in fact waiting. You know, I'm not saying anything, I'm not doing anything, but it's occupying my thoughts. And we don't know when God's going to repay. I mean, they're waiting for that to happen. You're supposed to be busy in the meantime, right?
Yeah, but what I would suggest is that you wait without the fretting. You're waiting, but don't do the fretting. Be anxious for nothing. Be anxious for nothing. Okay, so, and all I'm saying is it may be, but I don't know that, so I can't give you an answer because I just don't know that. Yes?
I think you're saying we don't retaliate in that situation.
Yes.
That's not the right way to handle it.
Yeah, and that's the way it's striking me too, that it's wait in that sense and not serve the Lord, and then, it's more like just wait for the Lord and he'll take care of it. Carol.
Wait for the Lord means you're not going to save yourself. If you do get involved, you're going to do just the opposite. You're going to compromise yourself.
Yeah, and Carol's done a better job with it than I have, Rachel, because she's referencing the first part of the verse then. It's, do not say what? See, I will repay. And that's the sense, I think, that now we're carrying into the wait for the Lord. He'll do the repaying, you won't. And he'll save you. So that's the way it strikes me anyway. Okay, in chapter 20, verse 30, the last one in 20, strikes that wound scour away evil, and strokes reach the innermost parts. We're going to observe the Passover on that one because we did that one in the series on discipline. So I'm just going to skip it. We've already touched on that one before. So 21:10 now. 21:10. The soul of the wicked was digging up evil in an earlier verse. What's it doing here? Desiring that evil. His neighbor finds no favor in his eyes. Remember we had that preceding verse and this person is looking and can't find any good. Remember? This is the same thing. It's just saying exactly the same thing. So again, I'm going to pass on because I'm relatively running out of time. But 22:3. The prudent sees the evil and hides himself. But the naive goes on and are what? Punished for it. And we touched briefly on this one once before, so I'm not going to spend much time on it. We had wisdom and did prudence before. But the prudent sees what? A prudent man can identify it. The prudent man is alert. They've learned how to scan properly, and they're not surprised or deceived. They see it coming. Okay? And then when they see it coming, what do they do? Well, I'll show you how strong I am, how wise I am. I can handle this. What do they do?
Avoid it.
Avoid it. Okay. All right. Let's go on to chapter 24. And these two, I think, go together, 24 verses 1 and 2. Do not be envious of evil men, nor desire to be with them, for their minds devise violence, and their lips talk of trouble. Now, brother, for all that might be said about Bill Clinton and who knows how many other people, you know, we've all got our favorite president that we think was just the most despicable, you know, morally there ever was. John F. Kennedy comes to mind. A lot of guys come to mind. My personal pick is LBJ. Who's that? Near as I can tell, LBJ was the most foul, vile, disgusting, rude, crude, and just absolutely callous and evil president we may have ever had. I mean, bar none. Just bar none. And I will never forget being a brand new Christian back in the last half of the 1970s. And I was subscribing to a monthly periodical called The Firm Foundation. Ever hear of The Firm Foundation?
Sure.
And they had a cover photo in The Firm Foundation of a bunch of preachers from Churches of Christ with LBJ. And they were so proud. They were just so proud. We're important. Look at us. And the caption talked about the very President of the United States. Those preachers were there with him. Okay? But who was the guy? Would you want to be with him? And they did. And I remember back then thinking, why? What difference does it make? What good is being done? Why should I care? So you made it into the Oval Office, you know, and you're shaking your hand, but you go home and, you know, look on any website tonight about Lyndon Baines Johnson's, you know, morality. It was just astonishingly disgusting. I mean, astonishingly, the things that that guy said and did. He treated his wife, brethren, nearly as bad as that Castro character treated those girls. It was almost that bad. I mean to tell you. And of course, it's all covered up. People try to ignore anything else, figurehead of the United States and everything. But I'm looking at 24 and verse 1 and thinking, don't be envious of evil men. You haven't got anything to offer. Don't desire to be with them. What do you have to spend any time with them for? I don't care who they are. Their minds devise violence. And their lips talk of trouble. And what did we learn just very shortly ago about using the language of evil? Where does it lead? Into evil. Well, who needs them? Right? You know, our glory is not in this earth, is it? And it's certainly not in human beings. Who cares? You know, we're busier. We've got other things to do. We've got more important things to do. Let those guys take care, you know, of the pathetic and unimportant stuff that goes on in this world, you know, like politics. And let us get about the business of bringing souls to Christ and, you know, let the dead bury the dead politically. It's the way I always thought about it. 27:12. A prudent man sees evil and does what? We just read that. The naive proceed and pay the penalty. It's a different way of saying exactly the same thing. Now 28. Not racing. I've only got about 2 more minutes, but I've only got 2 more lines too. So in chapter 28, we have first verse 5. Evil men do not understand justice, but those who seek the Lord understand all things. So should we be surprised when we're talking with evil people and they don't get it. Brother, what do you think about capital punishment? Good thing or bad? Eminently and preeminently good. And we need to have that blood atoned for when it's spilled. The Bible teaches that Old Testament or New. Okay? But what do the real white people think about capital punishment?
Oh,
I can't understand why anybody is barbaric. All that kind of stuff. Well, they don't understand. So how much time should you spend trying to convince them? You got better things to do, brethren. Go from the presence of a man when you do not perceive the lips of knowledge in him was a proverb we studied about 3 weeks ago. Go. Pearls before swine. 28:10. He who leads the upright astray in an evil way will himself fall into his own pit. You will reap what you sow. Verse 22. A man with an evil eye hastens after wealth and does not know that want will come to him. But Ecclesiastes has much to say about that, so we'll wait until we get to Ecclesiastes to deal with it. We're almost done. 29:6. In fact, I think that actually is the last one. There it is, yeah. 29:6. By transgression, an evil man is ensnared. But the righteous, what? Now, does anybody or anything caught in a snare ever sing or rejoice?
No.
So what about the snare? Did you get caught in it? No way. No way. That's a lot of verses on evil. And a tremendous amount of information about it, how to avoid it, nature of the heart that harbors it, how dangerous it is, how to escape it. Whole lot of information here on the topic of evil.